This Friday, April 20th, marks the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting, with 15 dead. Since then, we've witnessed school shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, Jonesboro, Arkansas, and on this date, April 16th, 2007, in Blacksburg, Virginia, the third deadliest shooting in the U.S. happened on the Virginia Tech campus. 32 people were killed. Public pleas from parents and national polls calling for changes to gun control laws did not seem to make a difference. But in 2018, something has shifted. After 17 students were killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on Valentine's Day this year, a movement erupted around gun control unlike what this country has seen before around this particular issue. Hashtag Never Again is gaining traction and even momentum. George Zornick, the Washington editor of The Nation magazine, whose latest article, How the Hashtag Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics, it's on the cover of the April 30th, May 7th issue, and he joins me now. Hi, George.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
So you've been covering the NRA for years. You've gone to conventions. You've covered mass shootings, unfortunately, and gun violence generally for many, many years. So I'm going to just start with a big, broad question for you. What is it about this moment that has caused this kind of disruption?
Well, you know, in many senses, it was a perfect storm. I mean, there was always going to be a little bit more of an aggressive, maximalist gun control movement after Barack Obama left the White House. Because what's important to remember here is that really there was no gun control movement to speak of, or certainly not the one that we see now, up until the Newtown shooting. I mean, Democrats really did not want to talk about gun control up until then. Barack Obama ran a whole presidential campaign in 2012 without ever mentioning it once, and that was with the Aurora Theater shooting happening right in the middle of it. And so when this gun control movement cropped up in late 2012, early 2013, it was always going to be kind of a small bore, let's see what we can get through Congress. Look, there's a president who wants to sign some gun control legislation. Democrats don't have 60 votes in the Senate, but they do control the chamber. So let's see what kind of negotiated compromise we can get through here. And so it was always going to be the case when Donald Trump became president that the gun control movement would move away from that a little bit, because Trump is not going to sign gun control, period, full stop. So it was always going to be a little more maximalist and more creative, and I think everyone expected that. What we didn't expect is that there would be a mass shooting that so galvanized its survivors and victims, and that these people would be teenagers who, are acting with such not only passion but a true understanding of political debate that I think a lot of adults don't grasp, certainly on social media. And so they've kind of broken through a lot of these tired dialogues around gun control, around a lot of issues, frankly, and are really kind of whipping up activism and passion around the issue that we haven't seen in several years.
Yeah, you wrote a whole entire article titled "The Adults Have Failed, So Students Are Leaving the Way." What is the main failure by adults that these students seem to be able to overcome or just blast through? What's so radically different?
Well, for one, they're putting it in an expressly moral terms, and so it's not kind of these tired debates about, the rights and limits of the Second Amendment and getting deep into the language. And, you know, a lot of times Democrats have been so fearful of the issue that they always have this preamble, and you can almost hear, you know, pick a Democratic politician, you can hear them say it. Well, I think, of course, people have their Second Amendment right to own a gun, but I want, you know, responsible limits on X, Y, and Z. You know, the kids are cutting through that with a very clear statement of, like, we're dying. These are our lives on the line. It's us who have to go through these drills in school every month for when an active shooter comes through. We never know when the next shooting is going to be, and they not only don't seem to be stopping, but seem to be accelerating in pace. And saying this is not acceptable. And I think what they're painting it as accurately is a basic failure of government. They're saying if the government cannot protect kids in schools from being shot, then, you know, what are they doing? What is the purpose? And so they've kind of, to borrow their phrase, they've just called BS on the entire dialogue.
You used an interesting word, tired, in a way that we've all become sort of used to hearing the same back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and it seems like you're saying they just cut right through the back and forth.
They have, and you know what they're also doing is they're really focused on building a movement, so getting people out in the streets, which we saw at the March for Lives. There's going to be a student walkout next week on the 20th. And so building an activist movement that survives past just the aftermath of a mass shooting, because that's kind of been the unfortunate rhythm of this debate since Newtown is, you know, horrific mass shooting, 1 week, 2 weeks of news coverage, outrage, maybe a legislative debate, and then it falls by the wayside. And the only motivator to get people interested, perversely, was a lot of people dying in a shooting. And so what these kids are trying to build is a sustainable movement that is going to keep people out in the streets, is going to keep the issue out on cable news and in the newspapers without, you know, the unfortunate tragedy of a mass shooting. And that's a particularly challenging task for them, particularly in these times. I mean, last week there were like three or four stories that would have been, you know, sustained 6 month mega sagas under any other political moment. So it's really challenging right now to keep a story in the news and keep, you know, voters and activists focused on it. But so far, tentatively, I think they're doing that.
I'm Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with George Zornick of the Washington, editor of The Nation magazine, about his new piece called How the Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics. And you were describing the sustainability and how this is going to continue to move forward. And one of the ways it seems to be moving forward is that these young activists from Parkland really seem to understand intersectionality. And they seem to understand that they're in a position of privilege as suburban, and David Hogue said it straight, I'm a young white guy, and the media follows me around. For folks who don't really understand intersectionality, I'm just going to read this definition of it. It's the interconnected nature of social categorizations such as race, class, and gender as they apply to a given individual or group, regarded as creating overlapping and interdependent systems of discrimination or disadvantage. So these Parkland activists have really started to invite in other young students, but students of color. Talk to us a little bit about how that has helped shape this movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fact. One of the basic facts of gun violence in America is that it disproportionately affects minority Americans. So if you are black in America, you are 13 times more likely than a non-Hispanic white American to be killed by a gun. And there's always been a sort of fundamental awkwardness since Newtown and this new gun control movement where you know, the focus has been, and not inappropriately, I mean, understand it, but the focus has been on these mass shootings that are primarily happening in suburban schools and movie theaters, shopping malls. The victims are primarily white. And so that's always kind of sat uncomfortably on top of the fact that there is a daily thrum of gun violence in our cities, and it's primarily claiming black and brown victims. And so what these kids are trying to do, and I think so far tentatively have kind of made good progress in doing, is focusing people's attention not just on the mass shootings, which of course they care very deeply and personally about, but on what, you know, on who is actually dying on a day-to-day basis thanks to gun violence in America. So before the March for Lives, which of course got a ton of coverage and rightly so, the Parkland kids showed up in D.C. a few days early, and they went to this high school, this charter school in Southeast D.C., which has very, very high rates of gun violence in that neighborhood. And in fact, the school is about 400 students, and two of them have been killed, shot and killed this school year alone since September.
Wow.
And so they had a rally in the gym with, you know, a lot of these students who don't normally get the kind of mass press attention for the gun violence that they're living through every day. And the Parkland kids kind of got up and said their thing, but they made sure the focus was on the voices of those students and kind of chiding. I mean, David Hogue directly chided the media and said, you guys don't, you know, show up when these things are happening here at Thurgood Marshall Academy. You're here because we are, but we want you to keep in mind, you know, who is really suffering under gun violence. And I think that dynamic is starting to change. I mean, in the very immediate short term, it was kind of unfortunate because Hogue had to leave that rally a little bit early, and so this mass of cameras followed him out into the halls.
They made his point by doing
right.
that.
Fortunately, they did. Yeah, but I think overall that dialogue is starting to change, and we should credit these kids for starting that conversation.
Why hasn't that happened before, do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's funny and frustrating because, and I spoke to someone from the Million Hoodies movement, which has been, which sprang up in response to the Trayvon Martin killing in Florida, because, you know, there were a lot of people in the streets, like Million Hoodies and the Black Lives Matter movement, that were calling attention not only to police brutality, but gun violence in their neighborhoods. And really, those things are one and the same. I mean, the rallying cry you often hear is that, you know, police violence is gun violence. This is it's sort of an offshoot of the larger issue of, you know, everyone being heavily armed and on a hair trigger, and these issues are all interrelated. And they, you know, that movement, while we're certainly aware of it, didn't get the same level of coverage that the Never Again movement is. So I think for some of those activists, and certainly the ones I interviewed, it is a little frustrating, not that they don't welcome now a more intersectional gun control movement, and one that's focused on, you know, let's not just stop these shootings in the shopping malls, but in our inner cities. Now, this, of course, it is going to complicate the movement a little bit. I mean, if you live in a really nice, wealthy area with good schools, and someone shoots up the local movie theater, the very straightforward policy solution is, well, let's get rid of the guns, and then life can return to normal. If you're living in a neighborhood where there's constant fear of the police and how they're going to use their guns, where there's economic segregation, and which creates a drug trade and poverty and over-incarceration, you know, gun violence is the final lethal byproduct of that. But just saying, let's mitigate the flow and use of guns, while important, is not going to be the end of the story. So as the movement broadens, it's going to have to kind of take on those challenges, but it can't really exist without it. I think what these Parkland kids overall are saying is, we can't keep talking about guns in America with this huge blind spot to who is disproportionately affected by that violence.
We all know the names of Emma Gonzalez and we know David Hogue, but there were a set of twins, Zion and Zaire Kelly. You write about them a little bit. One of them spoke at the march because his twin brother was a victim of gun violence, and they are from Southeast Washington, which you wrote about. We have a little bit of a clip of Zion describing his brother, who was running for class president and had been attending a college prep session one evening. And let's take a listen.
I was in contact with Zaire while he was walking home, texting him and calling him all through the night. About 20 to 30 minutes went by, and I became worried because the walk alone doesn't even take 30 minutes. I left my room to ask my mom where he was until I saw flashing blue and red lights outside my window. I told my parents that there were police cars and an ambulance on our street. We rushed outside, discovering that it was Zaire. That night, on September 20th, a robber with a gun was lurking on my streets for hours. On my walk home, he attempted to rob me, but I ran. Though he had an ankle monitor on, and he was supposed to be monitored by the police, he was still able to obtain a gun illegally and lurk in my streets and take my brother's life. He shot my brother in the head. Once we arrived to the hospital, he was pronounced dead.
There were so many powerful stories from that day. Young woman Edna Chavez talked about her brother being killed by gunfire in Los Angeles. These are incredibly powerful stories, and this may sound like an incredibly cynical question, but how do these stories help move this forward? I mean, we've heard the stories of Newtown, which were about tiny, small children, and that didn't make a change. So even though these really catch our hearts and can make us want to cry just listening to that, really, what can these kind of stories do practically?
You know, I think the entire debate is people weighing what is a fairly unclear prescription in both Supreme Court case law and in the Constitution for what, you know, how far does the right to own a weapon extend, and how do you weigh that against people who you know, like the brother of the student we just heard who was at this academy in Southeast, who was just walking home from class and is killed outside his home, and the many different victims of gun violence. And I think that the more these stories are told, I mean, I would say that though Newtown did not ultimately produce a big solution, a final, you know, overarching policy solution to gun violence, I wouldn't say that the movement hasn't been successful. I mean, we've seen in the wake of Newtown and then again in the wake of Parkland, there have been a lot of states, big states, that have passed some pretty strong gun control, further than even what has been envisioned realistically on the federal level. You know, you had in Florida after Parkland, though it certainly wasn't everything that the activists were asking for, you had a Republican legislature, which is very, very deferential to the NRA, which helped many of those members get elected, still passed some modest gun control measures that the NRA did not want. So, you know, things like raising the age for gun purchases in the state, beefing up the background checks. And I think in tandem with people hearing and understanding what the tragedy of gun violence is really like, particularly the stories that usually get, you know, two paragraphs in the middle of the Metro section of the paper, I think that when they hear that versus, you know, alongside legislators seeing that, hey, we can pass these small board things that the NRA doesn't like, and nothing happens. The sky doesn't fall on us. We're not immediately thrown out of office. Over time, I think gun control activists are optimistic, and perhaps appropriately so, that they'll keep making progress. And at some point, there may be a more rational legal structure around guns, but it's not something that's going to happen, you know, immediately this month, this year. But, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
I'm Allison Stewart, and I'm speaking with George Zornick, the Washington editor for The Nation magazine, about his new report, How the Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics. We'll continue speaking with George in just a bit. Later on the show, best-selling author Andrea Buchanan with her book, The Beginning of Everything, The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. Plus, Sam Adler-Bell, senior associate at the Century Foundation, looks at the issues with the test run for the 2020 census. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after the break. You're listening to WNYC Midday. I'm Allison Stewart, and joining me on the phone is George Zornick, the Washington editor for The Nation magazine. We're talking about his new piece, How the Never Again Movement is Disrupting Gun Politics. And when you have disruption, George, you have people who respond back. Let's talk a little bit about some of the reactions to this disruption and the Never Again movement. David Hogg, he's obviously one of the most visible Parkland survivors. He's very media savvy. He's great on TV. Laura Ingraham, a television host at Fox, you know, made fun of him, made fun of the fact that he was disappointed that he didn't get into a certain number of colleges. And she, as a result, has been hemorrhaging sponsors. I think last count was somewhere around 24, 25. My question about this to you is there some validation to how successful the movement is that people are attacking these kids individually and in ways that are unseemly, but in some ways that's a validation that they must be getting under someone's skin?
Well, you know what I think's been interesting about watching the backlash, particularly from conservative politicians and media figures, has been that very rarely have I seen them engage these students on the actual material issues of gun control. I mean, Laura Ingraham was just kind of dunking on this 17-year-old on Twitter for not getting into a college that he wanted to go to. A lot of, if you remember, right after the shooting, YouTube, the top trending video on YouTube was that these kids actually weren't real. They were crisis actors, and David Hogue was in the middle of that. So this had to be some kind of put on or scheme that you know, this is fraudulent. And a lot of the ways that they've been attacked have been stepping around, trying to discredit them without actually engaging them on the substance of what they're saying, which is, hey, someone just ran through our school with a gun and killed many of our classmates. This has to change. And I think in part, you know, that's because not only because they've been so effective, but because I think that the kind of pro-gun forces in the country are a little bit unsure of how to deal with these kids. I think they've they've momentarily been, I don't know if defeat is the right word, but they don't have,
dazed.
They weren't expecting
They're kind of dazed
that.
A little bit.
They are. They're on their back foot, and they don't know how to match the kind of moral clarity of these students calling out a problem and demanding a solution without getting into a lot of the silly stuff that we've seen from Laura Ingraham and others. So I think it is a credit to their movement. Now, slowly what's going to happen is the conservative media is going to whittle away and whittle away on these kids until, and it's probably already happened, the name, you know, David Hogue's face and name just becomes toxic to a certain set of people who are likely to be watching Fox News and so on. And that's, you know, that's, I guess, their best play, but it's a pretty low percentage strategy at this point.
How would you describe the NRA's reaction?
Yeah, I think they haven't really known what to do either. They do understand that they cannot forcefully attack these kids head on, as some of their, I'm sure they're happy to see Laura Ingraham do it. They're in a little bit of a dangerous moment because the NRA always functions much better when the big bad guy is, you know, President Obama or candidate Hillary Clinton or there's some nefarious liberal gun grabber that they can point to. It's hard to, or impossible to paint, you know, these student victims of gun violence as such. And really, the NRA is now the bad guy in this play, and it's a little bit of an uncomfortable situation for them. And I think what they understand is that they are for once and less and less popular than they used to be. I mean, I think they're at historic polling low. They're the sort of, they're, you know, President Trump is kind of a de facto leader of the gun control movement in that he reaped $30 million from the NRA to get elected, and he's the one who's going to decide on all these measures. They understand very well that Trump is not popular at all. And so what is really going to help gun control activists and the Never Again kids in particular is having the NRA and Donald Trump be the faces of gun rights. And so I think they're playing a little jujitsu with staying back a little bit. We haven't really seen them go hard after the Parkland kids. And I think Trump understands this too. I mean, he had that really bizarre cabinet room meeting, which I'm sure you remember, where he kind of said, oh yeah, I'm for all this. We should just do gun confiscation, I think was the phrase that he used. Which, of course, if Obama had even started to say the word confiscation, the NRA would have exploded. But I think he was, whether by design or not, very deftly diffusing this dynamic that they're so worried about, which is, like, I know that gun control groups went into that meeting hoping that Trump would pound the table and say, the NRA is fantastic, we will not give an inch on gun rights. And so I think the NRA and Donald Trump both understand the dynamic at play here, which is, for the moment, they're the bad guy and they're not particularly popular.
We're speaking with George Zornick, the Washington editor for The Nation magazine, about this shift in gun politics right now. And you wrote a really interesting piece where you went to an NRA convention, and I want to ask you about a couple things that you observed there. One thing you wrote, you said LaPierre, Wayne LaPierre, head of the NRA, understands the gun rights movement, as a culture war first and a battle over gun laws second. First, I'm going to ask you to explain that, and then I'm wondering if the Never Again advocates have adopted this in a way.
Yeah, that's a terrific point. I mean, you know, Donald Trump was kind of a strange candidate for the NRA to back. I mean, here's a guy who had no real discernible record on gun control, period, when he started running for president. In fact, the only thing we know is that when he was getting involved in New York City politics over a decade ago, he kind of flirted with gun control, being in favor of gun control, because that's, you can't really get into New York City politics any other way. So, but yet, you know, he received the earliest endorsement ever from the NRA. He was the first sitting president since the early 80s, when the NRA was a much different group, to visit their convention. So it seems like kind of a strange fit, unless you understand that the way that Donald Trump talks about, you know, dangerous, murderous, raping immigrants that are flowing over the border, and, you know, the very dark themes that we saw over and over again in his campaign, I'm thinking in particular of his inauguration speech, it's this vision of cities being overrun by dangerous criminals. I mean, that speaks exactly to the method that Wayne LaPierre and the NRA have been using to sell guns for quite some time. And you know, it's been a racialized rhetoric. You know, at the NRA convention in Atlanta last year, there were all these panels about, you know, self-defense against marauding illegal immigrants, as if that's a problem that your typical American or NRA conference attendee would face. But, you know, I think it's exactly right that they were kind of fighting this culture war, and Democrats were talking about expanding the background check system and you know, responsible gun safety measures. And there was just kind of a disconnect. And so I think you're exactly right. What these Parkland kids have done in part is meeting Wayne LaPierre and the NRA on the battlefield of a culture war and saying, okay, let's have this discussion about, you know, what we value and what is the real interplay between race and guns. I mean, you say that it's to defend yourself against, you know, illegal immigrants and inner city thugs, and we know what that means. And, you know, the Parkland kids are saying, no, this is what's happening to us. These guns are in our schools. They're killing our classmates. They're killing people in the city. And you know, let's have that discussion straight on instead of this disconnect that I think had been happening before and was really kind of tying the gun control movements, at least one hand behind its back.
One thing you noted in your piece about the NRA convention, that it was predominantly white. And as you just mentioned, that the threat that has been presented is non-white. We noticed there are certain studies that link certain gun control laws with expressions of racism. And I want to bring this back to sort of the first part of our conversation we had, which was about this intersectionality, about these Parkland and the Never Again folks opening up and being inclusive of brown and black folks into this movement. Is there a danger there, given this sort of this undertone of racism that goes through this, that, you know, the inclusion may be the good thing, but could it end up being a rallying cry for their opponents?
Well, I think what I would say is that rallying cry, it has already been shouted.
It's going to be there no matter what.
Right. I mean, that was at a full throat throughout the entire 2016 campaign. And I think, you know, now at this point, I mean, if you just want to be very bottom line about it in terms of voting, which, you know, I think is worth looking at. If you look at the 2016 election, when white voters were, the conservative white voters in particular, were highly motivated to vote in a way that nobody, the pollsters, didn't expect until election night. And you look at Democrats who had trouble getting out black voters in big cities, and I'm thinking of particularly places like Milwaukee and Detroit, where that really cost the Clinton campaign. I mean, you know, what if the Democrats successfully married their agenda with a gun control that isn't just pitched at let's stop the mass shootings in these schools, which, again, is very worthwhile and worth it, but here's our agenda to stop the gun violence that is taking a toll on the inner city every single day. You know, is that something that they can use to boost their numbers? Because frankly, the Republicans are already doing it.
It's interesting you should bring back the election, because I did want to point out one of the things about the Parkland campaign, let's call it that, is that they are registering kids to vote. You've got these sign up tables and sign up petitions for kids, like, make sure that you are registered to vote when you turn 18. Do you think this is going to be the big issue in the fall of 2018?
I think it will be a central issue. I mean, it's in this climate, it's so hard to predict what the one thing is, because
True.
There's like 10 insane things happening at once. But I do think that it's going to be a huge motivator for these kids to sign up and vote. And I have a theory about it, which I didn't fully put into the article, because I'm not, you know, I don't know 100% how to prove that this is true, but I'm going to float it here.
Yeah, work it out with us.
I think part of what's happening here, not that the Parkland kids and the thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids who march with them are not serious about gun control. They absolutely are. But I think a broader undercurrent is that they believe that adult authority has failed them, which I think it has. So if a lot of these kids, you know, were most of what they remember has been post the 2008 financial crisis. So they're looking at adults who have created this fairly weak to very weak economy, adults who just put reality star Donald Trump in the White House, adults who can't even protect them in their schools from gun violence. I think there is a larger youth movement building here, and some of the data points have been the Black Lives Matter and the Parkland kids, and even thinking back maybe to Occupy Wall Street as kind of a precursor. I think there is a very strong feeling among people under 25 and even under 18 that the adults have kind of screwed everything up. And you hear that rhetoric again and again in a lot of these Parkland kids' speeches and statements. And I think not only will this get them to the polls in 2018, but that, you know, the particular gun control issue, but I think that broader sentiment and urgency is going to keep them involved very deeply, you know, past that.
Sounds like the don't trust anybody over 30 movement we knew once upon a time.
Right, exactly. I mean, and can you blame them? I mean, if you think of all your frame of reference is from like the mid 2000s on to now, you know, I'm not sure that they're wrong.
Well, we have a few minutes left, and I did want to ask you, out of all of, since you've been involved in reporting about gun control for over the years, what do you think has been misreported about this particular moment and in general that's either been overlooked or not quite framed correctly, or has been framed only for a soundbite?
Hello.
Hi, did you hear me? I think we may have lost George. He gave us a good 39. Oh, George is back. All right.
I'm not sure what happened there.
No problem. Live radio. Well, the question I asked was, since you've been someone who has covered this for so long and in so many different angles, is there anything about this moment, this never again moment, that you think has been misreported or mischaracterized?
You know, I think there's obviously the you know, you turn on Fox News and I can give you about 30 examples, but I think that people are beginning to understand exactly what gun violence is, and that it's not just the white victims in shopping malls. But not only that, you know, the most interesting, this is the one thing I thought was misreported. David Hogue gave a speech where he cited a gun control stat of how many people are killed by guns every day. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. And the media kind of said, well, that's not really, it gave him like a half true rating on those fact checking sites. It said, yeah, well, he's including suicide, so that's not really gun violence. And there was a little bit of kind of media attention on that. And oh, maybe these kids don't have their facts right. And I think that was dead wrong. You know, violence is violence, whether you turn it against yourself or someone else. And I think one thing that the Parkland kids, because they've mentioned this, mm-hmm. and one thing that I think the media is coming around to is that exact point, is that, you know, having guns readily available to people who are in a mental crisis, produces bad outcomes. And we should talk not just about homicides, but suicides as well. And so I hope that both gun control activists and the media kind of start to get a better grip on that and don't immediately say, well, you know, these gun violence numbers are kind of cooked because half of them are suicides.
This is a conversation that could keep on going, and I'm sure we'll have it again. George Zornick, the Washington editor of The Nation magazine, thank you so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me.